Welcome to WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM on your dial. Next up, Alternative Perspectives, Atlanta's only queer radio hour. Hold on tight. And thank you so much for listening to WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM on your dial, streaming at WRFG.org, where you can always make a donation. Welcome to Alternative Perspectives. This is Atlanta's only local radio hour devoted exclusively to issues affecting Atlanta's queer community. I am your host. I'm queer. And my name is Greg Bossen. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you to Sharon for covering me when I need to be covered and taking the show, which she did last week. So Sharon is awesome. Thank you. The opinions expressed here are, of course, those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily represent the views of WRFG, its employees, board, volunteers, funders, or listeners. So tonight's show, I don't know if you've ever heard of it before, but there was a bar in the 1970s that was on Cheshire Bridge Road called Sweet Gumhead. It was primarily a drag bar, but of course they had dancing too, late night dancing. And this bar was a really important part of the growth of both the activist movement in Atlanta, but just in general, the gay community was an important part of our gay community, important part of our history. And so tonight we will be talking about Sweet Gumhead and a book that came out, A Night at the Sweet Gumhead, by Marty Pageant, who is an author who actually lives off of Cheshire Bridge Road, lived here since 1997. So I thought that that was an important important book. I don't do books a lot, although I did a book a couple of weeks ago. I'm not a big reader. But this book, you need to read because you need to understand about the history of gay Atlanta, and you can't do it without understanding what's been what was going on Cheshire Bridge Road in the 70s and primarily at the Sweet Gumhead. So with that, we're going to talk to him, and that's what our show is going to be about. But before we get to that,
news of the queer.
I know that's right.
Oh, no, she didn't say what.
All right. So I'm going to start by telling you a little bit of COVID news. So this is from Wednesday. So this was, you know, about 6 days ago. In intensive care units across Georgia are actually overflowing with critically ill COVID-19 patients, creating the latest crisis for hospitals trying to handle a fast-moving surge that has not reached its peak. In 10 of the state's 14 hospital regions, more than 90% of the ICU beds were in use last Wednesday, with two regions exceeding 100% capacity. The ICUs at some of Atlanta's largest hospitals were so full, they had to divert ambulances carrying patients who needed intensive care. Some hospitals that did have ICU beds open didn't have the critical care staff needed to use them. COVID-19 patients who need beds in ICUs continue to be the sickest patients, usually the ones struggling to breathe. And they need lots of care from nurses and doctors, and many are on ventilators. So we have a lack of space at hospitals. So if you get sick, not necessarily with COVID, but with something else, and you need an ICU bed, you may be in trouble. And just to let you know, our seven-day average is 7,857. It hasn't been this high since the beginning of the year, and it was never this high all of 2020. So at this rate, we should be in worse shape than we've ever been within the next 2 weeks. As a matter of fact, yesterday we had 20,895 new cases of COVID. So now, no doubt, those of you that were vaccinated very early on, the vaccine's efficacy is waning. And that is why we're going to need to get a booster shot. That's just the way it is. You're just going to have to deal with it. The vast majority of the cases, again, continue to be cases from those of us who refuse to get vaccinated. So I am hoping that those of you who have decided for whatever reason not to get vaccinated will rethink your decision, especially in light of the fact that Pfizer has been given full approval now, not emergency approval, but full approval by the Food and Drug Administration. So bad news all the way around in terms of COVID, but good news in terms of Pfizer getting full the full go-ahead from the FDA. And I really do hope that you will talk to your doctor, talk to friends, perhaps watch the news, perhaps listen to the scientists, and decide to go ahead and get the booster. They have tons and tons and tons of data showing the safety of this vaccine. Enough time has gone by. The reason why it takes so long typically to get the FDA approval for a vaccine is not the safety aspect. It's the efficacy of it, how long it's going to work, how good it actually is. That takes a little more time. So my point is, those of you that say, well, why it took so much longer with others, it hasn't taken long for this one, that's why I don't trust it. Well, you can trust that it's not going to hurt you, all right? And plus, never have they had so much data because so many people have already taken the vaccine. So please, I am begging you, go get vaccinated if you haven't gotten vaccinated. And then when September rolls around, for those of you that got vaccinated in January, it's time to get a booster. All right. So moving on, some local news here for those of you that are not aware of it. There are a lot of LGBTQ candidates that are qualifying for races here in Midtown. As a matter of fact, in a last minute scramble, former Atlanta City Council member Alex Wan and small business owner Courtney Dubai will square off for an open Atlanta City Council seat. The development in District 6 makes 10 candidates that are LGBTQ running for Atlanta City Council spots in November. That is awesome. I think that's awesome. And just to give a nod, other LGBTQ candidates running for Atlanta City Council this year include teacher Kelly Jean Lee in District 1, neighborhood activist Larry Carter in District 4, community organizer Liliana Bakatari in District 5, community organizer Devin Barrington Ward in District 9, business consultant Jerome Sharp, and attorney Brandon Goldenberg, who I know personally, for Post 1 at Large. Former State Representative Keisha Waits for Post 3 at Large, and Mike Russell for City Council President. So gay, 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 gay. So makes sense. It's a gay city. Enough of that. I think it's good news. Now, not so good news is good old Cheshire Bridge Road, which we're actually, that's where Sweet Gumhead is or was, and that's we're going to talk about on tonight's show with the author of a new book about Sweet Gumhead. But Cheshire Bridge Road is a mess, right? The bad news, if you don't already know this, is the fire that damaged the bridge on Cheshire Bridge Road, which is basically right next to the Heretic, BJ Rooster's, Taqueria del Sol. I guess Taqueria del Sol is the closest to it. That bridge is going to be closed for more than a year. They are going to have to demolish the bridge in total and build a new bridge from scratch, which is not what they had to do with the big bridge on the highway a year or two ago that got replaced in 6 weeks or 8 weeks, I think. This bridge is going to take well over a year. And the DOT is saying that the reason why it's going to take so long is because you have to tear the bridge down and start over. We're not even sure about the supports in the ground underneath it. So I get that. I still don't understand why it's going to take more than a year. I mean, you could tear that bridge down in a couple of days, I would imagine. So I'm not sure why it would take over a year to replace it. But nevertheless, it certainly is going to change life on Cheshire Bridge Road. And I'm curious to see what it's going to do to the businesses there that have already been suffering because of COVID. But anyway, we shall see what happens. Not cool. All right. Marjorie Taylor Greene. she, of course, is the state, the congressman from Georgia in the 14th district, which is in North Georgia. So back in February, shortly after she took up her role as a representative in Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene erected a large anti-trans sign on the wall outside her office. It stated there are two genders, male and female, trust the science, which is obviously not the case because what happens to people that are born with both sex organs? I don't know what she does about that because God made that happen. Anyway, the sign went up partly in retaliation to Green's neighbor across the corridor, Democratic Marie Newman, who has a trans daughter. How nice is that? Her daughter is trans, so Marjorie Taylor Greene puts this nasty thing saying there's only two sexes, male and female. That's just mean. Anyway, yesterday, Greene revealed on Twitter that her sign is still up, only now she's added to it, pasting, and this is what's really sad, hundreds of letters and cards from people all over the country have written to her, pledging their support and gratitude for her far-right political stance. So understand, she's not the only one here. There are thousands and thousands and I don't know how many people, perhaps millions of Trump-loving supporters who also are adamantly opposed and concerned and freaked out, even though it doesn't affect them directly at all, at the fact that some random stranger that they don't even know halfway across the country decides that they are trans. Somehow that bothers them. I don't understand these people. But anyway, just letting you know, for those of you that think that gay rights is no longer an issue and trans rights is no longer an issue, it certainly is. I guess most people would know that trans rights are a problem. But as far as I'm concerned, to be trans is a problem in the same is a problem for the straight community in the same way that being gay was a problem for the straight community. They don't like people that go against gender norms, okay? Whether it be being attracted to the opposite to the same sex or wanting to change your sex, doesn't matter. Either way, you're going against gender norms, and so trans individuals are part of our community and we need to support them. All right. Moving on. Let's see. What else do we have here? Oh, speaking of trans, a trans Atlanta activist has been named to Biden's presidential HIV council. And we've covered on the show that in the trans community in Atlanta, up to 50% of the trans black male trans community is HIV positive. So HIV is rampant in the trans community. Anyway, Atlanta's own Tori Cooper became the first black transgender woman appointed to the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS earlier this month. I am very humbled and very proud, she told Project Q. There is a lot of work that needs to be done. So there's this desire to just dig in and be part of something that really means a lot to a lot of people in this country. Cooper is the director of community engagement for the Human Rights Campaign's Transgender Justice Initiative, and the Presidential Council added her and seven other new members at its August 4th member, August 4th meeting. Another history-making trans woman swore Cooper in, Rachel Levine, the Assistant Secretary for Health at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, is the first federally official confirmed, federal official confirmed by the U.S. Senate. So how exciting. I think that's really cool. And moving on, let's see if we have time here. Yeah, we have a little bit of time. All right, so I like to talk about Poland a lot because I love Poland. I went to Poland. My ancestors are from Poland. I was there in 2015. And of course, Poland has become decidedly more conservative. But parades in the parades for LGBT rights took place under heavy police, presence on Saturday at the foot of Catholic Poland's most revered monastery in the south in Gdansk on the Baltic coast. The massive police presence, which included officers on horseback, was seen as the factor that prevented any clashes from far-right groups, which shouted anti-LGBT slogans like "No homosexual love" at the marchers. How can you imagine getting up in the morning, getting dressed, going, you know what? You know what I'm going to do today on this beautiful Saturday? I think I'm going to go down to a parade and yell out "No homosexual love." So anytime there's "no" with the word "love" in the same sentence, that's weird to me. Okay. I mean, how can you be against love? But anyway, whatever. There had been previous cases of violence by far-right groups against equality parades in Poland. And the far-right groups have support from Poland's right-wing nationalist government, which stresses the nation's historic attachment to traditional Catholic values. The third equality parade in the town of Sechowa, was undisturbed Saturday, even though far-right activists came from other cities to show opposition to it. How sad is this? We have to have a heavy police presence to prevent issues. Of course, here, even in Atlanta, we're used to those ridiculous people yelling and screaming anti-homophobic rants during our pride, which is coming back, by the way. I think we're going to have a real pride this year, unless, of course, COVID overtakes us again. Seems like it's going to. All right. And then finally, Sri Lanka discusses LGBTQ rights over and over, but clings to the past. The government of Sri Lanka is undecided on LGBTQ rights, but the matter is under discussion, government officials says. A video which surfaced on Twitter earlier this month showed the counselor posing the question, "Would you like your child to be a victim of a homosexual?" to an audience of police officers who all replied no in unison. The trainer is heard advising the policemen and women against the union of same-sex couples, adding that the members of the audience would not have been born had their parents been gay. She also claimed that governments in Sri Lanka have been toppled over their stance on homosexuality. The video came up at a weekly cabinet press briefing. Co-cabinet spokesman and media minister Kirthilia Rambukwela, I'm sure I butchered that, responding to questions, said the matter of LGBTQ rights have come up over and over again and has been taken up for discussion. So nothing's happening, which we are not happy about, but that's life in the big city. And with that, that is it for News of the Queer, and we will be right back.
Learn how you can help reduce secondhand smoke and get information about products to help you quit smoking at this 36th Annual Labor Day Blues Barbecue, Monday, September 6th at Park Tavern. just as social distancing and hand washing help prevent the spread of disease, eliminating secondhand smoke is critical to prevent acute chronic diseases and save lives by reducing the risk of heart disease, stroke, respiratory diseases, and lung cancer by up to 30% at a population-wide level. Get the facts on the impact of secondhand smoke, courtesy of Smoke-Free Rights for All, at the Labor Day Blues Barbecue, Monday, September 6th at Park Tavern. This is another public service announcement brought to you by your listener-sponsored and supported Community Radio, 89.3 FM, WRFG.org, your station for progressive information and handpicked quality music.
Those of you that aren't as old as I am, that is Midnight at the Oasis by Maria Muldaur. I'm not sure I'm saying that right. And this was a song that was popular at a bar called A Sweet Gumhead on Cheshire Bridge Road that, even though I am in my 50s, I had not heard of. Well, I've heard of it, but I certainly never walked into the bar, even though I grew up in Atlanta. But during the 1970s, welcome back. I just kind of dived right in. So you were listening to WRFG, Atlanta 89.3 FM on your dial. And again, this is Alternative Perspectives, Atlanta's only queer radio hour. I'm your host, Greg Bossen. Of course, we are streaming at WRFG.org as well. And for tonight's show, during the 1970s, which was kind of bookended between 1969 at the Stonewall riots, 1969, yeah, and then the AIDS crisis that started in the 1980s. But bookended there is the 1970s, right in the middle of those two time periods. And during the 80s, there were thousands of gay bars flourishing across the country, and particularly in the South. And in Atlanta, there was one such bar called Sweet Gum Head, which was on Cheshire Bridge Road. And this bar hosted nightly drag shows, late night dancing. It was quite a scene. And the bar and two people connected to it are the subjects of a new book that came out in June of this year. The book is called A Night at the Sweet Gum Head, Drag, Drugs, Disco, and Atlanta's Gay Revolution. And tonight on the show, we have the book's author, Martin Padgett. Thank you so much for being with us, Marty.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yes. So you don't live here. You did, or you still live here. I understand you've lived here for a while, but you didn't grow up here.
No, I didn't. I moved here in 1997, in January 97, and now I'm part-timer down in Florida and in Atlanta. So, I feel like after 20 years, you can call yourself a native. So as long as you can navigate by places instead of by streets, and as long as you know five different ways to get anywhere, then you're native Atlanta.
Yeah. I've been here since I was four, and people can assume that it's hard to find people that actually grew up here. I think you can consider yourself a native, definitely. Now, you are a journalist by trade, and I looked, and you've written other books. This is the book that you wrote before this one, back in 2007, was called Bobcat, 50 Years of Opportunity. Now, the book is not about a drag queen named Bobcat.
What a great name that would be.
Yes, it would be. But was the vehicle that's, used in construction. And before that, in 2005, it was Hot Cars, Cool Rides. So what in the world? Tell us a little bit about your career. Do I call you Marty or Martin?
Yeah, Marty's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm a transportation reporter. I've been test driving and reviewing cars and writing about the auto industry since the late 80s. And, you know, it's still fascinating. It's still interesting. I've done so many interesting things in the pursuit of stories for that, like riding on the hood of a car through a wall of fire. And that's one whole kind of reporting. But I knew that I always wanted to do something else. And I went back to school a few years ago and started writing this book as part of an MFA program. And I always pictured it as some big sprawling story of Atlanta history. But the closer I got to this story, the closer I got to my own neighborhood, you know, the more focused it became. And eventually it became focused on the nightclub.
The MFA, what is that?
MFA, Master in Fine Arts. It's a University of Georgia has the journalism school, of course, Grady College of Journalism. And they have this master's degree for narrative nonfiction writing. And they have other MFA programs now, too. There's one for screenwriting. There's one for filmmaking. And our side program was for writing narrative nonfiction.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. And so, and I know you're getting your PhD in history now. So I guess history is something that you're interested in. And I guess you lived in Atlanta, so you decided you'd focus on Atlanta. Now, I didn't ask if this was okay. Are you gay? Can I ask if you're okay?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So was it always going to be about something having to do with gay history in Atlanta then?
Not at all. When I started writing this project, I thought I would do something on the modern history of Atlanta. There are very few books that have taken place after the Civil Rights Movement. So I thought it would be a little bit of all over town. I'd written stories about Gwinnett Place Mall when it really started its downward spiral. It just never gelled together in the way that I wanted to. So as I was writing, I just kept coming back to the name of this nightclub that had shown up in interviews and research that I'd done, and I really didn't know anything about it. And that's in part because, you know, like you, I wasn't going out to bars in 1979. I was going to sixth grade, I think. But when I started to read more about it online, I found so much information and so many personal stories from performers who are still active, still around, you know, like Charlie Brown and Dina Jacobs and Tina DeVore. Just, you know, people who are still here who remember the place and remember the people and miss it.
Yeah, I'm tell us now, it was on Cheshire Bridge Road. And I, like you, I've seen in articles about it. It always gets brought up whenever you're talking about gay history in Atlanta. But I came out in 1986 and the bar closed in 1981. It was on Cheshire Bridge. Where exactly on Cheshire Bridge was it?
So if you know where the burned out Hulk of Happy Herman's is.
Yes.
I was right there yesterday. It's just the street right now is having a very hard time. Right across from Happy Herman's is a tire shop and next to a Waffle House and behind those buildings, the back entrance of that is where the nightclub entrance was. And it's still been a nightclub on and off. I'm not sure if it's open now because of COVID or what, but the building is still there. And it has been a nightclub since 1965 in one form or the other.
You're talking about that tiny little bar that's across from the Waffle House on the side street.
That's what was for a really brief time was the restaurant attached to the Sweet Gum Head. Or if you go further around the corner, there's two sets of double doors and that's the entrance to it. And long ago, the building was built, I think, as a supermarket. So it was the back entrance to the parking lot to the supermarket. And, yeah, the big middle section of that building was a nightclub configured to seat about 300 people.
Wow, I had no idea. That's wild. And I guess the entrance was from the back. I guess they didn't want to have a big street presence. So maybe you couldn't see it from the street. You had to go back back around to get to it. Where did the name come from?
Yeah, I think sometime in this.
Go ahead.
So I think the building sometime in the 60s, it got split up so that the front was stores and the back was the nightclub entrance because it was a hardware store and it was all like that. But you mentioned the name. So the name was coined or borrowed by the guy who owned the bar. He had already owned a couple of bars. He owned the original Cove and he had been a manager at Piccolo's, which was another bar that went kind of gay at night in the 60s. It was on Peachtree. When he started opening his own gay bars, he wanted to name one after the town where he grew up. And it's this little dot on the map in the Florida panhandle. It's barely a town. I mean, there are maybe a dozen houses. There's no schools, no grocery stores, just a strip of land. And in the middle of these really rich farm fields in Northwest Florida.
Wow. And the town is called Sweet Gumhead?
It is, if you can call it a town. It's just a very small community. There's two churches, but there's not even a gas station. So
wow.
I've driven through a couple of times. It's beautiful countryside, and it's right near Choctawhatchee Inlet from the Gulf of Mexico.
So gotcha.
It's just very fertile. There's, you know, cattle farms and horses and produce.
Yeah, and I guess people that hadn't been around a long time that are listening, you know, Cheshire Bridge back then, there were gay bars all up and down Cheshire Bridge. I think, was it Weekend's Warehouse or just the Warehouse? I think it was called over there where the Terra Theater is. There was a gay bar, which is kind of, you know, just across and down the street a little bit. So Cheshire Bridge is an interesting road, isn't it? It's always had kind of a, you know, I don't know what you, it's a road where you can pretty much do anything, have sex, do drugs. So, I mean, it's always been,
I always called it the gutter, right?
Yeah.
It's the gutter between Emory and Buckhead, and it's my gutter, and I love it. And it's, you know, in the last few weeks with everything that's gone on Cheshire Bridge with the bridge collapse and, you know, there are fires and violence. It just seems like it's a really bad time right now.
Yeah. Cheshire Bridge is...
It's changing despite all of that with all the new apartment complexes and...
I hope that you cut out a little bit. You're cutting out a little bit. I hope that it retains its character, though. I hope that... you know, every city needs a street like that, a little bit of a mini red light district. So I'm hoping that it'll retain that. So tell us a little bit, if you could, about the bar. Paint a picture of what a night at this bar was like.
Yeah. When it first opened, the first owner, Frank Powell, decided that he wanted to have a drag showcase. So it really was always conceived as a drag bar. And he hired professional performers who had toured drag circuits all around the country. Brought in a friend of his to choreograph shows, hired away talent from other bars. And for his ownership period was, I think, through 1974. So for the first 3 years the bar was open, it just had this reputation of being, you know, the place to see drag. And it was in part because of the way the building was built. There was an upper tier of tables. There was a lower tier that was big. It had a really big stage with professional lighting, and they had built a professional sound system into it. So I think it was Charlie Brown who told me it was like walking into a Roman theater because you'd go into the front door and there are people all around you, and you're like walking in, you can't tell if you're the warrior or the lion. It was the place where performers knew they'd arrived when they got a gig there. As it got older, it of course added disco music and had a decent sized dance floor, and it also kind of branched out to become almost a community center. It would host events for film premieres, and it would do live stage shows. The film that came to town, Desperate Living, John Waters did the premiere in the South for the movie at the Sweet Gumhead. They did legal fundraisers. They did political activity later on before the bar closed. It had really evolved a few times over its lifetime, but mainstay was drag, six nights a week, two or three shows a night, as long as they could stay open. Sometimes it was 2 a.m, sometimes it was 4 a.m, sometimes a little earlier than 1.
And why is it that you decided that that book, or I mean that that bar was important enough to kind of use that as a lens to discuss activism in growing activism in the gay community here in the South?
So the two parts of the story are activist and non-activist. And the non-activist side was fairly easy. You know, Atlanta had a few different types of gay life that was relatively open. And people would cruise Piedmont Park. People would go out to gay bars. And this was one of the most famous gay bars in the country. at the time, specifically because of those shows. So for me, it was interesting to track its progress, not only because it opened close to the Stonewall riots, but and closed at the dawn of the era of AIDS. It also had this, its own progression where the crowd and the performers increasingly got political. It was also one of the places that the activist crowd adopted to try and recruit people to help them, to get them to march in different protests. But it was also a place where the publisher of Atlanta's gay newspaper would come to sell ad space so that it could keep his newspaper afloat. It just ended up being this nexus of gay life that, you know, some of the other bars that I studied in the '70s just weren't evolved enough, or they were not involved in drag performances, or they were pure dance bars or just sleaze bars, which right. you know, we'll get to later. that's a whole other category, but this one was just for what it was singular. And so I thought that it was the best place to center the story.
So the book focuses on two individuals at parts. One of them is a gay rights activist by the name of Bill Smith. The other one mm-hmm. is a performer there, John Greenwell, who performed as Rachel Wells. But tell us a little bit about Bill and his history, if you could.
Bill was Atlanta native. He came out in the early years of college. He had gone out to Emory University at Oxford and decided that it was just too isolated, knew that he was gay and knew they wanted to have a gay life. So he ended up going to Georgia State and became one of the leaders of the Georgia Gay Liberation Front. With others like Burl Boykin and Steve Abbott, you know, they formed this activist group. They didn't have a protest the first year after Stonewall, like a lot of other cities did, because they didn't think that they had enough people to march. So they made up flyers and they leafleted an arts festival in Piedmont Park in June of 1970. But by 71, they decided they had enough people and that they were going to march, and the ACLU wouldn't help them get a permit for the protest parade, for the protest march. So they had to march on sidewalks. You know, they went from block to block and had to stop for stoplights and let pedestrians cross. And it was a stop and start affair. But it was captured actually on local news and got the interest and added more people to the movement. So he was fundamental. He was one of many people who were fundamental in getting Atlanta's gay rights movement off the ground. He later went on to become the publisher of the Barb newspaper, which was started in late 73, 74. He started writing a political column and then eventually was given ownership of it in 1975. But the paper never really made money. And in 1975, Bill decided that to keep it afloat, he was going to start an escort agency. And for a couple of years, the escort agency did actually keep it afloat. It did. The commission that he would take from pairing up people was enough to pay its bills and to pay the rent for it was a first attempt at an Atlanta gay center, the newspaper's offices, you know, his own personal apartment. But Bill also had emotional difficulties. His parents had subjected him to conversion therapy, and he had anxiety, and he started to seek out prescription treatment for it. And toward the end of his life, it overwhelmed him. And at some point, he was afraid that he was going to be outed as a member of the city's commissioners. He was a gay commissioner that sat on a volunteer board to help the city with issues of integration. He thought he was going to be outed for that. So he started to withdraw from all these different venues of political power in his life. And he eventually ended up taking his own life in Northside Hospital parking lot in 1980.
Oh, my gosh. I see what you're saying. This individual, I don't know, his life kind of captures the various ways that society's treatment of gays can affect your life, both positively and negatively. It's amazing. This is somebody that was really fighting for rights, which is one way of dealing with the problem. And then being overwhelmed by the homophobia of it is just that's remarkable.
Yeah, I think overwhelmed is the right word. But if you asked various straight people sophisticated about gay life or not sophisticated. And you ask them to say things that gay people did, literally one of everything would apply to Bill's life. And he loved disco music. He took drugs. He had relationships with men. He had relationships with women. He hired escorts. He liked escorts. He gave escorts employment. He was an activist. He was a television persona for the gay liberation movement. He's a really fascinating guy. And his desire to be a politician was just a few years too early for what Atlanta was able to handle politically.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to introduce you again. We're speaking with Marty Pageant, who just came out with a book here in June called A Night at the Sweet Gum Head. And you were listening to Alternative Perspectives on WRFG Atlanta. We will be right back.
Grab your tickets and join us as the WRFG Labor Day Blues Barbecue returns to the Park Tavern in Piedmont Park on Monday, September 6th. It's going to be a great afternoon of live blues featuring Sandra Hall, Atlanta's Empress of the Blues and the city's leading female blues singer. The Shadows, Blind Willie's stalwart house band, back from a 16-month hiatus featuring their new guitarist, Rick Hinkle. The Wasted Potential Brass Band, Atlanta's own funky, horn-driven septet. Garrett Collins Project, a funky blues rock trio who won the 2019 Atlanta Blues Challenge. And Skylar Softly, a rising star from Phoenix City, Alabama, who plays 50s-style Chicago blues plus jump and swing. Bring your appetite, because the Park Tavern will be selling tasty barbecue and cool libations. Blues barbecue tickets are $17 in advance via WRFG.org or $22 at the door. Kids under 12, as always, get in free. We look forward to seeing you at the 36th annual WRFG Labor Day Blues Barbecue, Monday, September 6th at the Park Tavern in Piedmont Park. The doors will open at noon and the music will start at 1 p.m. The Park Tavern is located at 10th Street and Monroe Drive Northeast in Midtown Atlanta. Additional funding provided by the Atlanta Blues Society and the Big Green Egg. Proceeds benefit WRFG 89.3 FM, your independent community radio station for handpicked quality music and progressive information. WRFG asks that all guests comply with the Atlanta Mayor's Executive Order, which requires all persons in a public entity or place to wear a facial covering or mask when indoors. For more information, go to WRFG.org.
All right. That's Easy by Melissa Manchester. And welcome back. You are listening to WRFG Atlanta 89.3 FM, streaming at WRFG.org on your computer. Welcome to Alternative Perspectives. And this is Atlanta's only queer radio hour. And we are talking with the author, Marty Pageant, of a book that he wrote that came out in June called A Night at the Sweet Gum Head, about the gay bar that was in Atlanta on Cheshire Bridge Road during the 1970s. So Marty, there were actually two characters that you focused on in depth in your book. One of them was Bill Smith, the gay rights activist. But another one was a gentleman by the name of John Greenwell, who was a drag queen, performed as Rachel Wells. And one of the songs that he did was Easy by Melissa Manchester, which is what we were just listening to, which is why I thought it would be cool to come back to the show with that. But tell us a little bit about John Greenwell, if you could.
So John was born in Kentucky, and his family was military, so they moved around a lot. And by the time he was in high school, they had ended up in Alabama. And he just decided that he was done. He didn't want to be the town queer in some small town in Alabama. So he had heard about Atlanta and got on a bus and went to Atlanta, had that classic sort of coming out story that, you know, seems like it's been told 100 times before. But I don't think a lot of people have told the story where that person ends up becoming Miss Gay America 1979.
Wow.
He went on within a few months of moving to Atlanta. He had roommates who had befriended drag performers who were coming to town to perform, and John became friendly with them as well. And it was a way to get into clubs. He could sneak in drag and get into nightclubs where he wasn't old enough to get in yet. He was only 20. And at the time, Atlanta's drinking age was still 21. So he realized he was good at it, and he made more money at it than working at the drugstore that he was working at. So within a few months, he had put together a persona and had a name and had done enough performing to become good enough that the club, the Sweet Gumhead, gave him a call when they were opening up and putting together their new crew. And from then on, he was on and off at the Sweet Gumhead until a few months before it closed for good. He won a couple of different titles. He was Miss Gay America, Miss Gay Atlanta, 1972, Miss Gay Georgia, 1977, and then in 1978, won Miss Gay America. And he was just one of several performers from Sweet Gumhead to take national drag titles. And he had a persona of, he would do a lot of different personalities, but his core appeal originally was like kind of glamazon, big blown out hair and ripped up outfits, and he would swing a boa constrictor around on stage. That kind of ended up morphing into a trio of imitations of older white ladies, like he says. He would do Carol Channing and Katherine Hepburn and some Barbara Streisand, but not a lot, because there were other performers who did that. And then toward the end of the 80s, toward the end of the 70s, after he had won his titles and started to think about retiring, he left Atlanta early in 1981 and went to Asheville. And you know, he was not in town for the world premiere of Sharky's Machine, in which he played a drag queen next to Burt Reynolds. And he wasn't here when the bar closed because he thought it was going to be too painful to be there. You know, he considered it a second home.
Well, now you mentioned Burt Reynolds, and I know in the book there's a little story about Burt Reynolds showing up, and Paul Lynde also, right, used to come there.
Many celebrities, yeah. Paul Lynde was a regular. He was a friend of Frank Powell's, and Frank Powell had told some people that they had gone to school together, but it doesn't check out, so I think they just might have been, you know, close friends and didn't want to tell anybody, but Paul Lynde would show up and he'd have a table at the front, and Waylon Flowers and Madam would perform there, and all sorts of, at the peak in the mid-70s, all sorts of performers made their way through. Melissa Manchester, Karen Valentine, even Dolly Parton. They'd swing by the club to see the shows. And one night in particular, Burt Reynolds came, and he had been filming down in South Georgia, and he caused such a stir that they had to hide him in Rachel Wells' dressing room. So John Greenwald got to sit and talk with Burt Reynolds for 15, 20 minutes until he was ready to go on.
Wow. Yeah, there's actually a picture of the two of them that I found online. So was Burt Reynolds filming, was that when he was filming Deliverance? Because I thought that was filmed in South Georgia.
No, he was filming Gator. And then he was coming back to do a couple of other movies, and he would swing through town quite a lot. You know, he was kind of the first wave of movie industry stuff coming through Georgia, and specifically through Atlanta. He filmed Sharky's Machine here, and I think Cannonball Run, one of them, was filmed here, and he owned a disco for a while in town. It was at the top of the Weston Peachtree, and it had his face in stained glass on the floor.
Oh, my God. that's hilarious.
Perfect. Yeah.
Wow. So there was dancing and everything, but Gumhead was always like primarily a drag bar. That was what it was known for.
Yeah, you couldn't avoid disco in the middle of the 70s. And you know, the Gumhead invested a lot of money in good sound and good DJs, and they played a lot of disco music. And it was just a smaller club than some that were disco specific. Like, you know, Backstreet would end up becoming specifically a disco. There was Limelight, there was the Far Library. A lot of those are later 70s, early 80s. You know, Atlanta had disco clubs that often had other functions, but really when disco became dance during the early years of the AIDS epidemic, that's when some of our big hallmark clubs opened. So the Sweet Gum had had disco between its performances, and it certainly had a lot of people dancing. But I think people considered it a drag bar. And it was a little bit of an earlier crowd bar, too. You know, you might go for a couple of shows, and then you might go over to the locker room, which specifically had a disco. And that's the other part of that corner that you were talking about, where the Publix is now. The north, you know, diagonally opposite where Sweet Gumhead is. That was the locker room and the locker room disco. It was a bathhouse. It was a disco. There was a door cut between them. So if you wanted to go to the bathhouse for a while and then go to the disco, you could do that. That was cool, which sounds amazing to think about that today.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one thing I think we've all noticed with the advent of social media, and there's just the bar scene isn't what it was in Atlanta, and I don't think it's what it was anywhere around the country, really. We just had Jungle close here a couple years ago. It's just not what it used to be. But I mean, there's a good and bad aspect of that, right? Because you don't necessarily need to go to a bar to see a gay person anymore. And maybe that's, you know, why it's not as important. But boy, it sure was fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was several steps along the way. And to me, one of the big steps was the closure of the 24-hour clubs. And I know there were police reasons for doing it. I know there were political reasons for doing it, but that was, what, 2001, when Backstreet and Armory and a bunch of 24-hour clubs, you know, saw their last dance. So to me, that was the death of Sundays as a party day in Atlanta. You know, when people would go out to the Heretic, or, you know, Sunday afternoons were one of the big reasons to come to party in Atlanta, for God's sake. And it's, you know, it just got shut down all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, why... Why did Sweet Gumhead close in 81?
It was an expensive club to run. And, you know, by the time they had paid all the performers, the lighting designers, the DJ, the costuming bartenders, barbacks, you know, there were just a lot of people involved in putting on a nightly production. Whereas discos, you would spend a lot of money up front to lay out the club and build out the sound system, but then they were just cash generators. You know, you didn't really have to change much other than the DJ and the records they brought. So it was more expensive to run on a daily basis, and it had never really been updated until like 1978. They kind of, you know, spit and polished it a little bit. But discos and nightclubs in general have a short shelf life. And the fact that it stayed open almost 10 years is a little remarkable, because many places shut down after a couple of years. You know, Frank Powell had more than a dozen nightclubs over his career, and more than half of them were just 1 or 2 years, and then they were done.
Yeah, no, that's not surprising. So what happened to those people, those drag queens, those customers, when that bar closed? Where did they go?
Well, some of them had other gigs booked automatically because they were either performing at other places regularly or as guest performers, like Lily White, who just passed away recently, went back over to, I forget what the club, I think it was called Sensations for a while after the locker room closed. But then...
I'm wondering if Illusions, I think Illusions was...
Illusions was pretty much the direct successor. So John Austin, who managed the Sweet Gum, had ended up managing Illusions, and a lot of the performers made their way there. And then in 85 or 86, they opened a bar back up where Locker Room was. It was called La Vida's, and it was named after one of the Sweet Gumhead performers who had died of AIDS in 1984. So a lot of performers ended up working at La Vida's as well.
Okay. For those of you that are young, so that bar Illusions, Charlie Brown performed there. It was a drag bar, and right across the street from that was Weekends. And Weekends was a 24-hour dance bar. And the person who used to card me and take my money at the door back in the early 1980s was RuPaul.
RuPaul kind of shows up briefly in my book because apparently his roommate had gone to the Sweet Gumhead and had heard that this phrase, you're naked and the rest is drag. And he adopted that as kind of his personal tagline. And he had heard that from some performer at the Sweet Gumhead, and talking to all the performers who were around, they seemed to think it was Mickey Day, somebody I didn't really write about, but read about a little along the way. My whole idea was this is a unique cultural moment, and a lot of people recognized it at the time, and maybe it inspired RuPaul in some little way.
Yeah, it was. Atlanta has always been known for drag, and it's also just was a mecca. Certainly in the 70s and the 80s, it was a mecca for anybody anybody in the South who was gay and wanted to meet other gay people, that, this is where you went. I didn't know that the gentleman that owned Sweet Gumhead also owned the Cove. Now, the Cove I've been to at the very tail end. That was a bar on Monroe Drive. That was a 24-hour bar, actually. I think it was. Yeah, that was a 24-hour
bar. It was. Because they had food service, because you could buy that nasty cheeseburger, right? And that made it a restaurant. the thing about, lots of Atlanta bars did that, and that was part of the end is near for the 24-hour bars when they realized that they weren't serving enough food. Frank Powell had started the Cove with a business partner, Chuck Kane, and I think he wanted to devote all of his energy to the Sweet Gumhead, so at some point he gave up his interest in the Cove. That was the earlier iteration. It was the same place, but it eventually closed in like 73 or 74 and then got restarted by Lloyd Russell. And Lloyd Russell was the one who owned it throughout the 80s and 90s. And that's a whole different story with that bar. But, it's another one of those places where people bring it up and like, oh, yeah, I went there a lot at 5 in the morning.
Right. That would probably be a good subject matter for a book. So we just got a few minutes left, and I guess I just kind of want to, kind of take a look overall at the book itself and what it's trying to say. So, what did you come away with, and what would you want readers to come away with? Are you basically just trying to show history, or is there a deeper meaning here? What are your thoughts?
I always like writing history from below. That's kind of the historian term for it. It's almost easy to write histories and narrative nonfiction about famous people who left a lot of historical record. But we don't have that luxury as queer people, because not everyone survived. Not everyone left a record of who they were, and not a lot of other people thought that they were important enough to document their lives. So it's one thing to write about Supreme Court justices or presidents or mayors. It's quite another thing to write about a community that was hardly documented itself. So I thought that Atlanta's gay community was, well deserved some attention, and it's time to do it now, because we've lost so many people from AIDS itself, and now we're starting to lose people, from natural causes. And I wanted to make sure that we got their oral histories down, that I got some of them on videotape, that we pulled together all the digital resources that we could of these very fragile existing paper objects. We have newspapers from the 70s that, they're at the Atlanta History Center. They're not in the greatest shape because they've lived for 50 years now. So they're now digitized, so anybody can read them. It's shoring up the past so that people remember that this place was important. And it was important for a reason.
Yeah. I think anybody who's grown up in Atlanta, and certainly any gay person that's grown up in Atlanta, I think it's required reading. So the book again is called A Night at the Sweet Gumhead, Drag, Drugs, Disco, which I'm all for, all of those things, and Atlanta's Gay Revolution. And the author is Martin Pageant. Thank you so much for being on the show. Martin, I appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Cool. All right. And that's going to do it for Alternative Perspectives. Thank you so much for listening. And please, I am begging you, it's time to go get vaccinated if you haven't done it already. All right. Next up, Peach State Festival. And have a good week. See you later.